Hello there once again, ye peg-leg foxel rats. Get ye back to the poop deck, won't ya? Cause you'll have to go the whole length of the boat, I think. Not really sure. Of course I am. I'm Assbeard the Pirate, and I know my nautical terms. Don't think for a moment that just because my beard resembles human buttocks, that I am not a pirate of great education. And I be here to educate you a bit as well, because in this here pre-show read, it be my purview to introduce you to the idea that you can support this here podcast by going to jimhodson.com or readmyfuckingbooks.com. Ye can join the mailing list to put your John Hancock right down on it, even though he was much later in the timeline than I am. Anyway, join the mailing list, maybe purchase one of the books written by the Jim Hodgson, whoever that is, what a schmuck. Listen, I just want to reiterate for the final time, it is not my fault that my beard looks like human buttocks. But it be my name, Assbeard the Pirate, and it's as good as any other pirate name, Blackbeard Schmuck, Goldenbeard Dickhead. It make me mad. The pirate gets mad when he laughs during... I do apologize for laughing during the read, okay? Listen, you're gonna enjoy the podcast, by God. Welcome to The Outliners.
My guest today, John G. Hartness, a teller of tales, a writer of wrong, defender of ladies' virtues, and some people call him Maurice, for he speaks of the pompetus of love. Come on, Hartness. He's also
really tired of writing bios.
Oh,
so
God.
That's where that came from.
I don't know what's worse, writing bios or trying to write the short treatments for books. But anyway.
Oh, God, yeah.
He's also the best-selling author of the epic award-winning series The Black Knight Chronicles from Bell Bridge Books, a comedic urban fantasy series that answers the eternal question, why aren't there more fat vampires? God, if I had a dollar for every time I've asked that question.
You'd have a dollar.
I know him from Bubba the Vampire Slayer, Quincy Harker, and I love your logline on your website, Dark Fantasy with a Side of Snark.
Thank you.
Good stuff. And you're also the co-founder of Falstaff Books, a digital and print publishing company based in Charlotte. They're bringing to life the best in fantasy, science fiction, horror, mystery, and dramatic literature. We'll have links to all this in the show notes, but long story short, he's a busy guy.
This is true. I work a lot.
Well, you and I were on a couple of panels. I met you at Contraflow in New Orleans, and one of our panels was, should you hire an editor? And I think we both were like, yes, panel complete.
Yeah, we'll be in the bar. See ya.
Yeah. I hope they got
it. Is that the one I showed up with a drink to, or was that the other one? Because I know I walked into one with like a 40-ounce Mike's Hard Lemonade, and that just set the tone right there.
That sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, you know, it's New Orleans.
We had some cool dudes. You know, we had Jason Federa. I'm not sure if he says Federa or Fedora, but he was on a couple of those panels. He's a groovy dude.
Yeah. Alan Gilbreth was down there from Dark Oak Books, who I've published with.
That's
Kimberly
right.
Richardson was there. She brought me an awesome Tori Amos tour poster that she had. She was getting rid of it. It's this lovely framed Tori Amos poster that she just didn't have space for. And I said, I'll take it. She said, okay, I'll see you in New Orleans. I'll bring it.
Nice.
Yeah, so those guys over my desk.
Those guys at the Dark Oak Press crew are a lot of fun. Good people to be around.
Yeah, I love working with them. Alan's a good friend and runs a nice company. Puts out some really good anthologies and books.
Yeah, in addition to just being kind of a hilarious dude.
Oh, yeah.
Which is always key.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about what you're up to. What are you working on right now?
Well, today I wrote a chapter in Black Knight number 7. I've written the first six of those are out from Bellbridge Books, and I'm contracted through 9, which will be the end of the series. So I'm currently working on book 7. I think I'm about 2/3 of the way done with it, so I'm at the place where I hate the book. Yeah. I hate every book I've ever written from about the 55 to 80% mark.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I just get to that point, I'm like, oh my god, shoot me now. Everything I write is crap. This is terrible. And then I get to 80%, I'm like, what am I on? This book's great. Let's go. And yeah. Blow through to the end. So I'm in the I hate this book stage, but I got a couple thousand words done on that. When we're done, I've got a new military sci-fi cyborg adventure thing that I've been working on. Cool. I'm going to try to do 1,000 words on that. And then I've got another new urban fantasy thing that kind of hit me last week. So I'm going to try and do 1,000 words on that guy too.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So then at some point I've got to get back to the properties that I'm committed to for the year. There should be another Shadow Council novella coming out this month. That's a spinoff from the Quincy Harker series. The latest Quincy Harker released 3 weeks ago. That's called Devil Inside. It's available exclusively on Amazon and through Kindle Unlimited. And then there'll be another Bubba coming probably in July.
Cool.
Yeah, I do about a novella a month.
That's good stuff. We, in the very first episode of this podcast, I expounded at length that one of our statements of purpose is that for the purposes of this podcast and life in general, in my opinion, but certainly for the purposes of the podcast, writer's block just is not a thing. We don't recognize that it exists.
No, it's bullshit. Writer's block's a load of crap.
Yeah. I don't.
Have you ever heard of anybody having carpenter's block or brick mason's block?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Go do your job.
Yeah. That's my thing. So, and I've spoken with you about that before. So I knew that would land with you.
Oh yeah. Pardon me. Con last weekend. So there may be a cough or two.
Yeah. You've got a little bit of the con crud.
Just a little bit. Allergies have been brutal here in the South this spring. So I'm up in Charlotte, so I don't have it quite as bad as you do down in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's my car's been yellow for 3 months. So. Right.
And not just because of the pee.
Exactly. That's, you know, gifts from my fans, the urine on the hood of my car.
Yeah, right. So I'm just looking now at your appearances list, and I know that you're a busy guy. You like to get around and see people. I mean, and it's part of, I think it's probably not only social and enjoyable for you, but it's part of your business plan to be in front of people.
100%.
And can you talk about how you sort of landed on that philosophy? Not only sure. Being prolific, but being seen a lot.
Well, there's two parts to it. First off is since I co-founded Falstaff Books and I am the publisher and the visible face of the company, I'm not just out there promoting my work. I'm out there promoting all my authors as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way that I've found to do that is to shake hands and kiss the babies.
Mm-hmm.
People buy things from people they like, and it's easier to make people like you if they've met you and you're not a dick.
Right. Right.
So I try to go be as many places as possible and not be a dick.
Right. Well, I've seen you
work. Sometimes I manage to go places, and sometimes I manage to not be a dick.
Right. Well,
the other thing is that with all these appearances, I'm also looking for writers.
Yeah.
Anytime I'm at a con, I'm talking to people about writing books for me.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Asher is a very successful self-published author, and he's now doing a series of novellas for me because we were on a panel together at Dragon Con. And I said, hey, you ought to write me something. He said, okay.
Yeah.
So now he's writing for me.
That's
cool. I'm just going along collecting writers like they're Pokemon. And the idea is that we'll all make a little bit of money together and raise everybody's visibility. So, you know, you get out there, you get in front of as many people as possible. And it's not a cost-effective way of marketing, but, you know, there's two levels of marketing and brand building. There's building your casual fans, the people who pick up one book here and there and might get, and the people you might get a sale or two each year. And those people are great, and I love them all. As long as they buy stuff, they're fantastic.
Right.
But then you've got your true fans. And your true fans are your core people. And they're the folks that are going to be evangelical about your work and get out there and recommend your stuff to all their friends. And those are the people that you have to build one by one. Mm-hmm. So those are the people that make it worthwhile to do like I'm doing right now. I'm doing 4 conventions in 8 weeks.
Yeah.
So that's worth it if at each one of these conventions I can create one true fan or convert a casual fan into a true fan. And I'd use myself as an example of this. Your true fans, I have a Neil Gaiman quote tattooed on my arm. I am a Neil Gaiman fan.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a limited edition print on my wall. I have a John Hairston painting of Death from the Sandman comics. I'm a Neil Gaiman fanboy.
Sure.
If you get just a few of those, you know, in the grand scheme of things, 1,000 people isn't really very many. You get people who are guaranteed to buy everything you release and tell 3 or 4 friends, oh my God, you got to read this. Then you're in like Flynn, man.
Yeah. Well,
so
I can't.
That's a lot of it for me.
I can't. I mean, I'm certainly a Neil Gaiman fan. I think everybody's got to be. I mean, I can't imagine a person that would say, I don't know, Neil Gaiman's not really for me. <That's> silliness. I assume that you've been watching the American Gods show.
I'm a couple of weeks behind, but yeah, I have watched at least the first 2 or 3 episodes.
How are you feeling about their choices?
So far, I really enjoy the show, and I'm working hard to keep my head divorced from the book as canon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying it as this is a good story, and I would watch Ian McShane read the phone book.
Oh, yeah, same.
For hours, I would sit and watch Ian McShane read the phone book. So the more of him that's on television, I'm down.
Yeah.
But I also fear a little how successful that show will be with people who aren't at least casual fans of the book. Because it's pretty damn weird.
Yeah, it is.
And if you don't know at least to some degree what's going on, or you're not in geek culture enough to at least know that this is supposed to be something that's cool and you like, you might be out in the cold a little bit.
Yeah, I went back and read the book again just to... I don't know. When I was reading it again, of course, I'm enjoying the book, but I'm thinking to myself, you know, what I'm doing right now is just boning up so that I can be mad when I watch the show. I mean,
that's why I haven't reread the book, because I knew the show was finally moving forward, and I was like, because I've got the 10th anniversary revised edition on my Kindle, and I've got the radio drama on my Audible account. So I intentionally have not read those because I don't want to be that guy.
Right. Yeah.
It is a visually amazing show, and the risks they're taking with the visuals on the show I think are wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're I think they're doing a great job. I think some of the choices that they've made are interesting.
Yeah.
I'm behind like you, but I guess I understand why they've made some of the choices they have, but also some of the little jokey sort of things that they've added have really surprised me and made me laugh. And, you know, I'm a snob about that kind of thing sometimes.
One thing that didn't resonate with me very well in the book that resonates with me really, really well with the show is the dead wife calling him puppy.
Uh-huh.
That rings truer to me in the show than it did in the book, actually. And it's probably the actress's diction or something in the way she says it. It comes off, and it's that I have a better visual on Shadow as a big, strong, imposing guy. So that juxtaposition of his visual with his nickname works really well for me, and I think it's actually coming across for me stronger in the show than it did in the book.
That's interesting.
I think so. There you go. That'll be something that you can get 20 comments on saying what an idiot your guest is.
Well, if it takes some of the
never better.
If it takes some of the heat off me, I'm down for that.
Anytime you need a moron, I'm your guy.
Well, I'm really glad that you had a moment to agree to do this. You know, you got a lot coming out, man. That's got to feel good.
Yeah, I tallied it up, and between the stuff that's already at my editor, she has two of mine, one novel and a novella. I have a novel that I need to polish. I have three that I'm currently actively writing. With everything I've got cooking, I've got over 10 titles to come out in the latter half of 2017.
That's pretty good.
So, yeah, you know, Wells Fargo will appreciate it because they still own my house.
I'm trying to get on the stay on the 30-day sort of release cycle. You know, we're both members of the 20 books to 50K thing, so I think we both kind of understand that philosophy, but I'm trying to keep that momentum going.
I hate a lot of the things on there.
Yeah, I don't cherish every post, but you know, the philosophy is interesting.
Yes, I think that there's a lot that can that group and that philosophy has a lot that people can take away that's positive. The mindless adherence to the right to market concept, I'm not crazy about.
Yeah, that's interesting. Nor am I. And I talked a lot about this to Bevan, just about how when you're I want to write humor. I'm a humor guy, but I also want people to die. You know, you can't put your book alongside Bossy Pants and say, okay, we're both humor writers. You know.
Yeah, it's very different, and even with stuff like, say, Christopher Moore, he's an amazing comedy writer. But, you know, even his stuff, Fool, is a great example. But it's still very different from some of the stuff I'm working because I blow up a lot of shit.
Yeah.
You know, I kill a lot of people.
Well.
But I'm still writing comedy.
Yeah, I just enjoy that. I mean, I think about, how can you really laugh unless the consequences are dire, you know?
Yeah. Everything gets elevated, and that's where your real release of tension comes from. You can go back to Shakespeare. It's why that porter scene in Macbeth is so damn funny, because everything else around it is so damn serious. Same with Hamlet. The gravedigger scene in Act 5, Scene 1, before Hamlet makes his way back to Denmark, the gravedigger talking to the skull is hilarious. And then you counterpoint that with Hamlet talking to the same skull. Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio.
Mm-hmm.
So the higher the stakes for your characters, the further you can go for comedy.
Well, yeah, the stakes were pretty high for Yorick. I mean, he's a skull.
Well, yeah, he's been dead for a while by the time the play starts. It's fine.
Yeah.
He died a relatively natural death.
Well, alas, anyway.
One of the few people in that play that did.
Okay. Are you ready to enter the crucible that is not a crucible?
Bring it.
Speaking of plays.
So is this a crucible that is or is not a metaphor for McCarthyism?
Oh, God. I don't...
You got a theater guy on the line, dude. If you're going to serve me up softballs like that, I'm going to have to take them.
We put that one on I guess I was in... That was in college by the time we did that one, but... you know, pretty tough play. I mean,
it is. There's a lot going on in there, and I designed lights for a production of it in community theater here in Charlotte. Shit, I guess by now it's almost 10 years ago. It ended up being a good play, but there is a lot going on, and to do it justice, you have to ignore, you can't play up the McCarthyism metaphor, because it works on its own. So you have to trust it.
Yeah, scary.
Otherwise, it falls apart.
It's scary, and also it's tough to direct in some ways, I think, because you have to tell actors to not act so much.
Yes, absolutely.
which is something they do not want to hear, usually.
No, it's not. I used to tell all my actors that acting is bullshit. Just be...
Yeah.
That'll be fine.
My understanding is that there are some very famous directors who have the same opinion. Like, it's all in the casting kind of thing.
The casting is well over 50% of the job, at least for a theater director on the level that I was.
Right. All right. Well, let's not sidestep.
Let's now, make a book.
Yeah. So, as you know, we talked about this briefly off air. Your prompt comes to you from a man who is known to you.
Yeah, I'm so fucked.
His name is Robert Bevan, and he's a great fan of yours, so he's, I guess, tried to do his best to make it tough for you, but you're not going to have any problem with this.
So, he just has to remember that anything bad that he does to me on this, I'm going to revisit the next time we do a taping of Authors and Dragons, which is the podcast we're on together. So
I have heard that the most recent episode is among the best.
I think it's probably the best episode we've ever done, just because it was a live episode at Con Carolina's last weekend. We were all pretty much still sober, and the crowd, we thought, you know, if we're lucky, well, at Contraflow, the con you and I were at together, we had like 8 people in the audience.
Right.
We had almost 30 people in the room.
Wow, strong.
At Con Carolina's. And they were with us.
Nice.
They knew the jokes. They were playing back. It was great.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's also a good place for people to jump on, because it's a self-contained small episode. You get a sense of what kind of morons our characters are. So if people haven't listened to it, basically what it is, it's 6 comedy, fantasy, and science fiction writers play Pathfinder every 2 weeks. So we record it over Skype, just like we're doing this podcast, and we put it on the internet. And awesome. We're the worst adventuring party in history.
Well, we will throw a link into the show description. Certainly worth a checkout.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Give it to me straight, Doc. I can take it.
A man is alone in a zoo. All the cages are open and animals are running around everywhere. And this guy snuck into the zoo because he thought it would be cool. This man has a bottle of scotch and some condoms, and a stipulation is that he must use the condoms in some way. And he also said that the only armaments the guy has are something like a mop or like a soup ladle sort of a thing. So he's not carrying a usual complement of guns and knives and such.
But he's got a bottle of scotch, a pack of condoms, and a soup ladle.
Yes, and all also, if I may quote Bevan directly, there's lions and shit running around.
All right.
So what are you thinking? What's that put you in mind of?
All right. So where I'm going to go is, if we're going into a fantasy world or an urban fantasy setting, I'm going to put this, I'm probably going to make this be a Bubba the Monster Hunter novella.
Okay.
So Bubba's gotten the call that there's a were-something in town.
Mm-hmm.
And they've tracked it to the zoo.
Okay.
Bubba's on his way home from the store to date night, and that's why he doesn't have any of his weapons.
Okay.
Because he had to borrow Agent Amy's car. So he's not in his truck, which has a load of weapons under the seat.
Right.
He gets the call that, holy crap, somebody's let all the animals loose in the zoo, and that's the last place where we saw this were. So it's a full moon. We don't know what the monster is. And he's got to go, and he's going in, and he's got a plastic shopping bag with his scotch, his condoms, and a soup ladle in it.
Okay, good. I like it.
All right. So that's going to be that'll be our chapter one, is getting him in there.
Right. So this is our sort of life as normal phase.
Yeah. This is our act one, when we put the characters in the tree.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we can probably spend a chapter we can spend a chapter just with, because we've got inherent dick jokes with Bubba in the condom aisle, and then asking people where the extra, extra large condoms are.
Right. Yeah, I was saying, while he was describing this prompt, I was like, you know, we got to give Hartness somebody to talk to as main characters, because he's good with the wisecracky, you know, dialogue.
Oh, yeah. Well, that also, if we make it be Bubba, he's got an earbud that puts him online with Skeeter all the time.
Right.
So he can basically talk to himself and have his gay best friend making jokes back at him.
Good.
So that gives us that as well. So we'll do a chapter of setup, and then we'll get him into the cage.
Yeah, you just mentioned a minute ago, in Act One we put our main character up the tree. Do you want to just finish that metaphor just so people understand?
Sure. Yeah, basically the three act story structure kinda goes like this. Act One is a shorter act usually, and it's you put your characters in a tree. And that's basically the setup. You have, like you mentioned, your real life section of the story. And you get them out of your real life. And Act One pretty much stops at, and then the shooting started. Or, and then I stepped through into fairyland.
Right.
Or, and then I woke up as a vampire and ate my best friend. You know, that's the end of Act One.
He had it coming.
Act Two is you set the tree on fire. So Act Two is you blow shit up. And Act Two is most of your narrative. It's probably 70% of your story, because that's where your plot twists are. But the whole goal is you've got them in a tree, you set the tree on fire, and then Act Three is they get out of the tree.
Right.
So, you know, it's your rising action, your fall, it's your rising action, your climax, and Act Three is pretty much your climactic point, and then you've got a little denouement at the end, your little epilogue or your falling action.
Right.
So, yeah, that's how that metaphor goes. And I don't remember who I stole that from, but...
Well, I think it's just out there in the ether. I don't think, you know.
Yeah, it is. Because somebody once in conversation said, yeah, you told me this great thing, and I thought it was brilliant. And I was like, I think it's brilliant, too, and I wish I were smart enough to have made it up, but I heard it somewhere.
Yeah, well, great artist steal, right?
Absolutely. So the first part of Act Two, I would start with Bubba getting hit with poo flung by a monkey.
I like it.
Because that's going to, one, flinging poo is funny.
No question.
And a 6'6" former defensive end for the University of Georgia Bulldogs getting hit by a poo flinging monkey is even funnier.
Agreed.
Plus, it gives us something to do with our soup ladle, because he can scoop the poo back and fling it back at the monkey, which will not have very much effect other than to make Bubba feel better.
I like it.
But then he realizes that he can fling rocks with the soup ladle and give him a little more accuracy. So, see, that's okay. How we're going to progress.
Yeah, we got a weapon going.
Now Bubba's got a missile weapon. So we'll have Bubba deal with monkeys for a little bit and realize that the monkeys aren't A, that damn dangerous, and B, none of these are rare monkeys. So
they're monkeys all the time.
Yeah, they're always monkeys. So that'll be our first, you know, mini conflict. Then we'll probably hear a scream.
I like it.
Because there's got to be security guards or zookeepers or somebody, because Bubba's going to have to save somebody. I think, have you seen Justified?
No.
Okay. Patton Oswalt has a character in Justified called Constable Bob. And he's like, he's a little bit like Paul Blart Mall Cop.
Okay.
Only it's played by Patton Oswalt, so it's brilliant.
Right.
And it's written by the guys who wrote Justified, so it's really brilliant. And he carries a freaking AK-47 in the back of his Gremlin.
Now I want to check it out.
Oh, yeah. Justified's one of my top five television shows ever. I recommend everybody check it out.
Wow.
So I think I would have then automatic weapons fire be heard and Bubba go running off and find the zookeeper, the zoo guard equivalent of Constable Bob, surrounded by something like something super innocuous. Like he's surrounded by the bodies of six dead antelope.
Okay, that's interesting. Tell me about why antelope.
Because they're herbivores, so they're not actually going to hurt somebody. But this guy's so shit scared, and he's such a terrible security guard. But as soon as he heard that the animals were loose, he went into his locker and got his automatic rifle, which is patently illegal for most people to own.
Right.
So, of course, he has one.
Yeah.
And he sees these beasts coming at him.
They're coming right for us.
They're coming right for us. So he kills them. And Bubba's like, dude, you make the guy who shot Bambi's mama look like the president of damn PETA.
Okay.
And then he takes the gun from him, and it's empty, but he, like, I don't know, takes the magazine out and smacks the guy in the head with the magazine or something, and the gun's now useless because he's had one magazine, and he emptied it into a bunch of friggin' pronghorn antelopes. But now he's got a foil with him, so we've got this new guy who's going to be stupid. So we not only have to hunt down the were-whatever that we don't know what it is, and we have to make sure that none of these animals actually get out of the zoo to hurt anybody, but he's got to make sure that Tubby the Wonder Rent-A-Cop doesn't get killed.
Right, but he's got to keep him along because he does know the lay of the land and he knows where everything is, and I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. He serves as a good, you know, old man, your old gypsy narrator, or old Romany, person who knows the lay. Yeah, person who knows the lay of the land. He's your guide.
I like it. And he also serves to wrench up the conflicts a little bit for our main character.
Exactly, because his response to everything's going to be, shoot it, shoot it. And Bubba's going to be like, I done told you I ain't got a gun. So, all right, so we've had monkeys flinging poo. We've got Paul Blart Mall Cop killing a bunch of antelope. I think next we need a stampeding rhino a hippopotamus.
Oh, yeah.
Because hippos are mean.
They really are. They look kind of cool and cute, but they're not.
Yeah, and those teeth are super sharp. So right as he's gotten the Patton Oswalt character settled, we'll have him feel a rumble underfoot. We'll just make it a whole big stampede of crap. We'll have everything be running.
I like
we'll start, and we'll start small. So we'll see, like, I don't know, some small thing that they have in zoos, a honey badger. Not a very good zoo, but
that we'll have a honey awesome.
Badger come running by. And then we'll have something else, some middle-sized thing, a couple of hyenas. Hyenas are good mid-sized things. And then we'll see, like, the one remaining antelope or whatever come hopping by, and it'll stop, and it'll look at Constable Bob and just give him a dirty look, and then jump off. Because,
like,
you
it.
See, we can anthropomorphize all this stuff because we're writing comedy. It doesn't have to make sense.
Right.
It ain't real, folks. There ain't real were-monsters out there. So as we're going up the scale, we finally get to, like, a hippo comes running by, and now Bubba's worried, and now they start climbing stuff. And Bubba has to climb a fence behind Constable Bob, and he's got his shoulder up this dude's ass, trying to shove him further up, because he's in shape, because round is a shape, and this dude is built like a sphere.
Right.
With another sphere on top of him. He's like, what's that thing, BD-88 from the new Star Wars thing, the little orange and white robot?
Oh.
BB-8 or whatever.
Yeah, BB-8, that's it.
Yeah, imagine that, climbing a tree with a buzz cut.
Sure.
So Bubba and that dude climb a tree, and then the elephant comes running along, and boom, 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 boom. And right before the elephant gets to the tree, a rhinoceros runs into the tree and knocks Constable Bob and Bubba out of the tree onto the elephant.
Okay, I like it.
So now they're riding the elephant, stampeding through the zoo, and they're riding along, but they finally get situated, and Bubba's like, he sits upright, and he's like, okay, we're good. And he sits up straight and gets smacked right off the back of the elephant by a tree branch. And and he looks up and he sees Constable Bob riding on the back of the elephant, just bumpity, 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 bump, disappearing around the bend. And he's like, well, that happened. Then we ratchet up the tension. So then, because we've had, like, high comedy, high comedy, high comedy, now we can really... Bubba looks up, and he looks over, and he sees eyes.
Ah, okay.
And then he looks over to his other side, and he sees eyes. And now the big cats are coming. And there's the pride of lions.
Uh-huh.
And they're all female, because the female lions are the ones you got to look out for.
Right.
Male lions just kind of lay around and screw and kill other male lions. Females go out and do the work. And Bubba's 6'6" and 350 pounds. He looks like a good meal to a couple of female lions. And he's looking. And he's like, this is not going to end well. So Bubba climbs a tree. He climbs the same tree that knocked him out off the back of the elephant. And that's when Bubba learns something very important. Lions and tigers can climb trees.
Yeah.
Bubba is an educated man, but not that educated. He didn't know lions could climb trees. So he's climbing, and he gets up to about as far as he figures will hold him, and then he looks down and realizes he has weapons. He has a bottle of scotch and a box of condoms.
Oh, man.
So Bubba makes scotch-filled water balloons out of the condoms. Throws them at the lions, and then pulls out his lighter and makes a Molotov cocktail out of the last of the bottle of scotch, sets the lions on fire.
Beautiful.
Works great. The lions are on fire. They've jumped down out of the tree. They're stopping, dropping, and rolling because, you know, you don't want to actually kill the wild animals. One, fans hate it when you kill animals. And two, I don't need no PETA protest for my book.
Right.
But as usual, there's a problem. You see, that's the thing. When you're working in Act Two, it almost, it's kind of like an improv game where when you're doing improv, it's always a yes and.
Right.
Is your response to everything. In writing and building tension, it's always but then.
Mm-hmm.
So Bubba has set the lions on fire. The lions have all run off. But then Bubba realizes that he has also set the tree on fire.
Right.
So we have the character up the tree, and he has set his own tree on fire. Working our metaphor for storytelling into the actual story.
Why not? Right?
So Bubba jumps down out of the tree, turns around, and sees the biggest damn porcupine he's ever seen. This porcupine is 4 feet tall at the shoulder.
Holy moly.
And it stands up on 2 feet and takes a stubby little front porcupine legs and flings them at Bubba, and spikes come off of the porcupine and shoot at Bubba like damn lawn darts. And Bubba suddenly realizes, as the porcupine gives him an inadvertent Prince Albert and pierces his junk, that he has finally found the were creature he was hunting the whole time.
Yeah.
And he now has to fight a were porcupine.
Oh, I love it.
That can shoot spines at him, and he can't actually hit the thing without getting stuck.
Right.
So he jumps over the fence into one of the habitats, probably the lion habitat, because he knows it's damn empty by now. So he jumps into, no, he jumps into the polar bear habitat. So he jumps into the polar bear habitat because there's ice all over the place. And he makes him a giant ice ball, flings it at the porcupine's head with his soup ladle, and knocks the porcupine out cold.
I love it.
And then I'm standing there looking at this butt-naked asshole who was turned back human when he fell unconscious. And I'm thinking, well, I'm in here. I'm safe. At some point, I'm going to have to jump out of here and arrest this dude or whatever. But for now, I think I'm just going to hang out. But then I felt this cold, wet nose nuzzle me right under my arm, and I looked around, and there was the cutest little Coca-Cola commercial I'd ever seen, as a little baby polar bear was trying to snuggle up to my leg, which was great. It was precious. It was adorable. And Mama Polar Bear was 3 feet behind him, looking pissed as hell.
I like it.
So then Bubba climbs to the roof of the polar bear habitat and waits for sunrise and back up.
Gotcha.
Because otherwise he'd have to kill all the animals, and we don't want him to kill the animals. So he's just going to kind of tuck the baby up under his arm because it's cute.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just going to sit on the roof of the polar bear habitat till morning and wait for sunrise.
I like it.
There we go.
I want to take you back just a few seconds.
All right.
Bubba was about to jump into an animal's habitat, and at first you were thinking, let's have him jump into the lion's habitat because we know it's empty, but then you changed to the polar bear, and I think mm-hmm. I know why, but do you want to talk about why?
Because in the lion habitat, I would have had him fling rocks with the soup ladle, but I needed him to end with another, oh crap, there's a critter. And I thought a chunk, I could find more funny things to do with him knocking the were-porcupine out with a snowball.
Yeah. I was thinking
I can make that funnier.
Okay. I like it. I was thinking you decided to change gears because you were like, well, he knows that the lion habitat is empty, but if it's empty, then what's he going to do in there? So.
Yeah, no, I was having him jump into the lion habitat to grab a rock. And then I was like, nah, let's have him do a snowball. That'll be funnier.
I like it. I'm with it.
And that happens a lot when you're working with comedy. You're like, okay, we'll do this. We'll just, oh no, wait, this other thing's way funnier.
Yeah, I do that, you know, especially when I feel like I don't even know if it's funnier, but it's something I'm more interested in writing than.
Yeah.
If I'm not interested, I figure the readers have got to be bored.
Absolutely. And, you know, you just push. Basically, a lot of times I just push at that envelope until my editor pulls me back.
Yeah.
So, or until my readers pull me back. My ARC team will say, hey, so maybe 27 Sasquatch dick jokes is one too many. I'm like, okay. We can cut it down to 26 synonyms for Sasquatch dick. That's fine.
You're saying it in a funny way, but I think what you're trying to say is that when you're writing, you bias towards moving forward, getting it done, and getting it out there, and then sort of worrying about doing the editing and polishing later on.
Well, yeah, I don't edit anything until I'm done with the first draft. Right. Ever. I mean, typos, if I see it like within a sentence or two. But yeah, I get it onto the page. And then my process is a little different than a lot of people's because I spent several years working in journalism, and that taught me to write fast and write tight. So I usually do one cleanup draft, and then I send it to my editor. A lot of folks have to take a couple more drafts because, you know, I was at 500,000 words of published writing before I got into writing fiction. So I had more experience with getting a coherent story told. That was just a benefit that that was a place I started with from, which helped me a lot.
Sure, but that's a learnable skill.
Absolutely. It's 100% learnable skill. You know, by the time plus I've been doing this now 7 years. So by the time you've been at it 5 to 10 years, you know how you tell stories.
Well, I'll say that this is the first one we've had so far that seems so, you know, completely formed. But it's interesting to me how different authors approach it differently. I mean, some people are thinking, in my mind, I'm kind of thinking about tent poles first, and then how do I get from here to the next tent pole kind of thing. But, you know, it's right what you say about once you're in Act Two, you just do Act Two stuff.
Yeah.
And I think you kind of...
I knew from the jump that we were going to finish this by flinging something out of the soup ladle and knocking out whatever the were creature was.
I got you.
I had no idea we were going to have a were porcupine until literally until the cats ran off in that thing. I was like, and it's a were porcupine.
I love porcupine because it's silly, but a big porcupine would really be able to fuck you up.
Exactly. That's how I was going through the list in my head, and I was like, and I've never seen one. I've never seen anybody write one. So I was like, let's go somewhere stupid that nobody's gone.
I like it. Yeah. I'm always trying to have that same, you know, it's the jokes are going to be similar because the same things are funny now that were funny 200 years ago. But we can at least reach for new monsters or different combinations or weird situations, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, hey, I'm telling the same dick jokes that Shakespeare told.
Right. And just wrapped in a different scotch-filled condom.
Yeah, my meter's a little different. But yeah. And yeah, as soon as I heard condoms and a bottle of scotch, I was like, okay, fireballs.
Right. And that's just from writing all kinds of crazy weapons for a long time.
Well, and I kind of get to cheat a little if I'm making up a Bubba story on the fly, because I've published 32 stories in the Bubba the Monster Hunter universe.
Right.
I got those pretty well on lock.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, that's, hey, experience is valuable.
Absolutely. We did an anthology real recently called Lawless Lands, which is a weird Western stories. And one of our invited authors had to drop out about 2 weeks before we needed edits to be complete.
Uh-oh.
And I was the publisher, and I went to the editors and said, all right, here's the deal. We can try and find somebody else, or I can just put a story in of mine. And they said, well, what do you have? I said, well, nothing yet, but I can have something written in a week. And they said, plus my fans will then be more likely to back the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
So we added a Kickstarter backer reward to say, for $100, you get to pick whether Harkness writes a Harker or a Bubba story.
Oh, I like it.
It lasted less than an hour, and somebody said, done. He's writing Bubba. I was like, wow.
Nice.
Should I ask for $200?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that hurts. But hey, you'll know for next time.
Right. So I wrote a brand new Bubba story that's exclusive to this anthology, and I was able to do it in a week because I know the character so well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have but two hills left to climb.
All right.
First of all, we need a title, and I think that'll be easy for you, but we need a title of this novel that we've outlined today.
Let's see. With Bubba, I usually steal titles from music. Well, with most of my stuff, I steal titles from rock songs. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Animal is too basic. Wild Wild Life.
Okay.
Talking Heads song.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, Wild Wild Life, a Bubba the Monster Hunter adventure.
I like it. Nice. This has come together really well. And finally,
way too much insight into my process.
That's what we're here for, man. We're here for that insight into the process of a guy who's written, you know, as many titles and many millions of words, you know. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, finally, we'll ask you to come up with a prompt for our next author.
Do you know who the next author is yet?
I think it is going to be Katie Hogan. Who is
okay? I don't know Katie, that's fine.
She is one of the funniest people in the world. She writes a lot of sketch, so she's very familiar with theater. She's just got this. She's got a way about her when it comes to writing dialogue and sketch, and she's really hilarious. So, if that gives you any insight,
all right. So, let's have. Let's have a 20th century woman travel through time and end up on Blackbeard's pirate ship.
I like it.
She has with her a Swiss Army knife and a flare gun.
I can tell you right now, Katie will kill that.
Yeah.
She'll murder it. Love it.
All right.
John Harkness, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. You're like, I don't know, you're like assembled in a strange wizard's lair somewhere to be to be an outliner's guest.
Brother, I'm happy to do it. Let me know when this airs. I'll pimp the shit out of it. This was a lot of fun.
You bet. Thanks, man.
All right. Thank you, brother.